SiriusXM Sports presents
At the Races with Steve Bick.
Enough! Horse racing, handicapping,
interviews.
This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back at the races on this Monday, and as you've heard, if you've been listening today, one thing that I've for years hoped to do was utilize a list and notations I made. I got to tell you, this has got, I think I started this in the Belmont press box, if I'm going to make a guess, from 12, 13, 14 years ago. And I remember going around as I started to accrue the names regarding Metro Turf, Figs Form, and the Racing Times. And one of the people I went to was Evan Hammonds, because Evan shared two of the innovation publication experiences, both at Figs Form and at Metro Turf. And we fleshed this out. And this piece of paper, Evan, is in my lap. And I have finally got this conversation sequence started, because what a perfect opportunity with, you know, racing, you know, very abbreviated right now. And it's a pleasure to welcome Evan Hammonds.
Hey, happy to be here. And again, yeah, I would say that's about right. On the 10 to 12 years ago, but I remember the conversation, and you know, you look around the landscape today, there's still a lot of people around that were a part of one or both or all three. I was a part of two.
Pretty funny. And which came first? Figs came first, I think.
Figs came first, and interestingly enough, hanging on my wall at home, I'm in the office at the Blood Horse now, is Volume 1, Issue 1. But it came out about this time, 1989. And I remember it was late March, early April, and I had a recap of the Toboggan, which was on page one. Won by the Phipps lay down with Jose Santos, up, as I recall.
Unbelievable. What was the date? What was the
opening? I think it was March of 1989. And I remember walking, seeing a very tiny ad for a startup racing publication in Soho. And it was just so intriguing. I called the number and went down there. And when they found out that I had worked at the Blood Horse previously, I think I was given an ID card right off Jump Street.
Who was behind it, Evan? Who was the brains behind Fix Form?
Well, the owner and operator was Robert Sinn, who was a very intelligent, smart guy. I guess it made his name in business in New York and Manhattan, but was also a handicapper, and came up with the figs. I mean, they're you know, essentially figs numbers, sheet type numbers. He came up with his own numbers, and they were very good. And he, I guess, saw the need to turn that into a racing publication, which I think if he'd probably just stuck to the numbers, he'd probably done a lot better. But, you know, starting a publication, going up against the Racing Form, there's a lot of overhead, a lot of expense. And I think that was ultimately the demise of it. But the genius behind it and his numbers were really good.
Robert and Pamela Sinn, right?
That's correct. Yeah, and she was, I believe, a trainer at some point. I don't know whether she was training at the time, but they owned some horses and but spent a lot of time, you know, digging into the numbers and coming up with their own speed figures. And you know, they were, I could, you know, they even today they probably hold up pretty well with what's out there today. If they were still around.
And where were you at the time? You were living in Kentucky already?
No, at the time I was living in New York. I was working for McMillan. I'd gone from Blood Horse to McMillan Publishing, and was, you know, not exactly, it wasn't as sexy as working in the racing industry. So it was a pretty interesting draw. And I remember going down, they had their offices on Spring Street down in Soho. There wasn't a whole lot going on down there at the time. And walking in, there was, I think I had the interview with Ed Fontaine, who was the editor, and Professor Iggy Brzezinski, who was, I think, a guy from Philadelphia who was their general manager. And it was an eye-opening experience. It was, you know, it's like the Wonder Years, looking back on it, because you walked in there to this huge warehouse office in Soho, and there was just this row of the little Macintosh computers, the original Macs from the late 80s, and I'd never seen anything like that. It was, you know, the technology at the time was far surpassed what any other publication was working with.
The list that I've got, and you can augment it, and also, talk about the overlap or when some of these names came in. And Ed's going to join us in about 10 minutes. But okay. Doug McCoy.
Yeah, he was, I can't remember. I think he was, you know, he was at the track. And we had this newfangled thing called a modem, which was just stunning. And he could write up his track notes. We had our own track notes for the charts and everything, and they would... I think we only had like one modem thing, and Ed would have to plug it into his computer, and it was just fascinating to me that you could get all this copy, you know, through your computer line. And again, this was, you know, 40 years ago, and yeah, he was in the track, as was Wolfman. Is it Richard McCarthy?
That's a name that's not on the list. I've got Doug. I've got Keith Fustel.
Yes, Keith was our guy, and I can't remember. I think he was at the old garden, at the new Garden State Park, which was
right.
Yeah, because Ed Fontaine was the. You know, the editor, and then there was Steve Feldman, who kind of ran the New York edition, and then I ran the quote-unquote Mid-Atlantic edition, which was Philly Park, Garden State, and Maryland, and Mr. Fustel was our man. I think he was at Garden State Park at the time.
Kenny Peck and Jim Kachulis.
Yeah, Kenny Peck, and I'm not sure whether we paid Kenny or not. He was just a kid right out of school, We had a lot of fun with him because, you know, he was new to everything. Jersey guy, I think he was right out of college. And I remember the funniest thing was we were trying to get him to do some handicapping things, and which he was interested in and very good at. But there was a race at the Meadowlands called the Chief Pennykeck, which was like some minor state bred stakes. And so we tried to come up with this great feature with, you know, Kenny Peck does the Pennykeck.
That's pretty good.
Anyway, we came up with whatever we could come up with. We were scrambling for ideas, but we had a lot of fun ideas and a lot of good times. If you go back and look, I mean, the 1989 was an outstanding year of racing. You know, you had the, you know, Easy Goers, Sunday Silence, rivalry going that spring and throughout the summer. You had horses like Safely Kept running, and I think Bayakoa had come into her own in New York, and it really was a magical year for racing.
Well, and the edition, I've got two copies, and the edition I put up that was in my office, and I put up with a tweet, comes from October 15th of 89, Open Mind, primed for Beldame, and Jim Kachulis wrote it. There's also the Brian J. Stakes at Philly, and Steve Kurtzman wrote that. I've also got a couple of names that very sadly are gone. Mike Martin did the photography, and Neil Cook was involved too, correct?
Well, he came in later after Fixed Form folded, I think, in like late November of 89. We only had about a 6-7 month run. He was brought, I guess the assets were sold to Rupert Murdoch, and that was the impetus for the Racing Times. So I think that's when Neil came in, but Neil wasn't there for fixed form. But one thing, going back to Mike Martin, who is a great photographer, I just met him. He would come in with a stack of photos, you know, begging us to print them in the paper. And one other very innovative thing that fixed form was we were published in Manhattan, and we had color on the front page, and we were the first color newspaper published in Manhattan at the time.
How about that?
Yeah. The Times, Daily News, Post, I think, was still black and white. I think Newsday was color, but that was published in Long Island, not in Manhattan. So that's one thing. Another illustrious feather in the cap of fixed form.
I've also got Bob Scalza and Carlo Spada on the list.
Yeah, well, Carlo Spada was also one of our track men, and he was, I think he might have been at Garden State Park, and Mr. Fusel was in Maryland. I can't remember which. Things get a little foggy after 39 years, but Bob Scalza was on the desk along with Steve Feldman and a handful of others. I remember we had some young woman who was a copy editor who was right out of school, and I can't remember her name, and I'm sure she didn't have any bylines, so if I went back through issues, couldn't come across them, but she was amazed with all the shenanigans and chicanery and horse racing things that were going on. And also, too, we were just a few blocks away from the Chinatown OTB, which was one of the busier ones in the city, and so a lot of times we'd run down. We spent a lot of lunchtime betting Aqueduct and Belmont at the OTB, so luckily we made it from paycheck to paycheck.
How much of the work, Evan, you know, it was editorial? How much, because people forget, you know, how much of a handicapper you really were. I mean, you were analyzing races way more than you were doing any feature work.
Oh, sure. And as editor too, you were writing some, not a whole lot, but also, making sure you had good copy coming in, editing that copy, and then and you'd have to sit down and zip through the figs. You couldn't look at the racing form. You didn't have any access to the racing form. You know, for like Philly Park, Pimlico, and Garden State, and then put that out. And then at the same time, the other guys were doing New York and Florida, and then we did have an edition in California, and I can't even remember anybody who worked in the California office, but it was a lot smaller than the one in New York. But you're right. I mean, you had to sit down, and once you got whatever pages for the edition put together, you zip through three racetracks and handicap the car.
Ed's gonna join us shortly here, Evan, and you mentioned the, you know, when things failed and the assets went to Murdoch and Steve Crist was getting the Racing Times going. When did you move over to over to Metro Turf?
Yeah. Well, it's funny. We were putting together I can't remember who came in. Some guy came in and said, "Okay, we're shutting down. We're going to put out one last good edition." And some people weren't super motivated, but Ed was very motivated because I think he had an interview the next day at the Racing Form. and eventually a lot of us did go over to work at the Racing Form, but they had a new publication they wanted to get going, which was kind of a hybrid Racing Form and program called Metro Turf. And it was, there was Ed Fontaine was there, Steve Feldman, myself, Bobby Smith, and we had this other guy who was pretty good handicapper. His name was Dave Lipton.
Dave Lipton, my first exposure. Yeah. Let's welcome in the great Ed Fontaine. Eddie, good morning.
Eddie, hey, what a blessing.
Eddie.
Hey, Evan, congratulations. I was going to email you, but I always knew you'd make something of yourself someday.
Yeah, I owe it all to you. I learned everything. Everything I learned from Eddie Fontaine.
Yeah, I taught you everything you know, but I didn't teach everything I know.
Okay, all right. How you doing, Ed?
That's an old Charlie Whittingham quote, by the way.
Yeah.
I'm fine, Evan. How are you guys
good,
doing?
Good, good. Well, you were the editor of Fix Form, so walk us through some figurative spot plays and tell us about the right field corner method and all the other handicapping angles you had.
Well, you know how the thing started. You know, did you guys talk about Robertson at all yet?
Yeah. Tiny bit.
Yeah, yeah. Did he, the way he came up with the formula that to manufacture the speed ratings is he'd taken a graph and he'd taken the world record at every distance and plotted it on a graph, and amazingly there was a straight line through from 6 furlongs up to 1.25 miles, and because of that straight line he was able to develop an algorithm, and then he adjusted it by class and track condition and everything. And that's how he came up with the Figo graphs and the Figo tips and the whole thing. It started out at American Turf Monthly. We were selling monthly updates, track variants, and you got a little computer, and you were able to come up with speed figures. And it was so popular that he decided to start the newspaper, which started. I think the first edition was right around St. Patrick's Day.
Yeah, I thought it was late March, somewhere around there, yeah.
Yeah, somewhere around there, and then it ended like a little after the Breeders' Cup.
Mm-hmm. It's a good run. Were you the first editorial hire? You were the editor, right?
Yes. I'm working at American Turf Monthly, so I can't. You know, he asked me if I wanted to take over, and I said, "Yeah, why not?" So anyway, we had a good run. We had fun.
Ed, where were you, and where at that point in your career? What were you doing, and you know, to make this kind of a move, and basically be involved in the launch of something completely new?
Well, I'd been working in the magazine business since I got out of college, and I'd been working at the Hearst magazines so I had a lot of magazine experience. So then I also had an interest. I'd become a thoroughbred racing fan, and the editorship of American Turf Monthly opened up. So I went over there about 1982-83 and ran American Turf Monthly and Racing Star Weekly for 6 or 7 years. And then I went to Fix Form.
Unbelievable. I didn't even realize. I did not even realize that you'd spent that much time at ATM, which in and of itself is a wonderful topic. I went through the list of names, Ed, that with Evan that I had collated, and Doug McCoy and Kenny Peck, Steve Feldman, Bob Scalza, Kachulis, Mike Martin with the photography. I've got Peter Berry's name in here as well.
Yeah, Peter Berry was I think the West Coast editor when we opened up an office out in Los Angeles.
Yeah, and I can't remember how. I think the West Coast office might have just been one or two people. It was pretty small.
Yeah, it was very, very small. But The numbers were pretty good, but he was going up against he had this notion. This guy Robertson had the notion that he could take on the daily racing form, and that had been tried before, and at Sports Eye, and it never worked. I think the guy who ran Sports Eye would open up a daily paper, and then the racing form would pay him to stop publishing it. So I think that's what Robert Sinn had in mind, that he'd start his daily paper, and that the racing form would throw him some money to go out of business.
And did they do that? We went out of business on our own.
Who else came through, Ed, that you hired, and some of the people that I may have missed here that launched their journalism careers in racing through Figs?
I think you pretty much got everybody that, Evan certainly, and Steve Feldman. He's working for a floor covering, owns a floor covering publication now. And Bobby Smith came over later at MetroTurf. He took over for me at American Turf Monthly when I left.
Ed, we had two copy editors. Who were they? You remember?
Eileen Clark.
There you go, Eileen Clark. There you go. Very good.
I forget his last name, but he'd worked for UPI, and he was an older fellow.
It was a ragtag bunch, but I think we put out a lot of fun articles and had a good time.
And we were very state of the art. Everything was done on Apple computers. You know, all the writing and all the producing of the graphs and all of the page layout was all done on screens. You know, very very state of the art. And I remember finally when I did go over to the Racing Forum a few months after Figs Forum closed. I walked in the door of the Racing Forum down in Hightstown, New Jersey. And I was like, boy, now I really hit the big time. I can't wait to see what kind of state-of-the-art stuff the Racing Forum has. And I walked in, and there's a bunch of old guys sitting around a bunch of desks pushed together, and they're typing their headlines on old royal typewriters with carbon paper stuffed in them.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah, when I went there, you went from working on these apples, and the first question was, "You want electric or manual typewriter?"
it was like going back in the time machine, only going backwards.
Ed, did you guys both go together to Metro Turf at that point in late '89?
Pretty much.
Well, yeah, Ed was first.
You went to the Racing Forum first, right?
I went to the Racing Forum first, but then they had a couple of guys in locked in a closet. They were trying to put out Metro Turf, and I think after a couple of weeks on the desk, they chucked me in there with you guys.
Yeah, Mike Mullaney was with Metro Turf for a while too.
Yeah, and Litvin was in the office for a couple of weeks, and then he was like, I got to go to the track, and where he worked from the press box.
Greg Gallo too, right, Ed?
Greg Gallo headed it up. Yeah.
Yeah, Greg Gallo had been the sports editor for the New York Post for years, and then when Murdoch sold it, Rupert Murdoch owned it, and Rupert Murdoch sold the Post, and they fired Greg, and then Rupert Murdoch bought the Daily Racing Forum, so when they started MetroTurf, they hired Greg, Then Greg worked, at the Racing Forum for several years, and then Rupert Murdoch sold it, and Greg got fired again, and then Rupert Murdoch bought the Post again, and Greg Gallo got hired back again to run the New York Post, where he eventually hired me.
Best movie ever made, right?
There's the connection, and then the rest of your racing, your turf riding career at the Post at that point. Mm-hmm. You mentioned Mullaney. Dave Feldman contributed to Metro Turf.
Dave Feldman. Oh, the guy from Chicago, right?
Yeah, yep.
Jody McDonald also, I think, would write a few columns every now and then.
Done WFAN
radio.
From Philadelphia. He was a huge racing fan.
Yes. He contributed a few columns to the Figs Forum, too.
And I've got a name, Kerbal, K-E-R-B-A-L.
K-E-R-B-E-L.
Kerbal.
Corbell. K-O-R-B-E-L, right? Great.
Is that Glenn Corbell?
Actually, yeah, Glenn Corbell, right. And he was at Metro Turf, right, Evan?
Yes. Well, the best thing about Metro Turf was you had the races in there too, but you had the opening page that had the entries and whatnot, and it was almost like a like the comics page in a way, because we also had this woman who gave us horoscopes every day.
That's right.
It was my job to call her like every Tuesday, and she would give me the whole week you know, worth of horoscopes, and it was always like, you know, brown horses do well today. You know, it was always something that was like very that pretty much fit anything.
These back in the days when Mike Smith was, you know, the really, you know, back when he was really the hot jock in New York then, and she'd say jockeys with initials MS should do well.
Yeah. But I don't know whether we paid her or not. But I had to call. She would give us the whole week. You know, she would read it off to me. You know, like Wednesday. You know, Grays will shine today. Yeah, it was just
Nancy Regalmudo, I think was her name.
Yeah.
Oh my God!
Yeah, we had this photo of her, you know, whispering into a horse's ear.
I remember that. I've got a couple of copies downstairs, and you know, there were several innovations, particularly in MetroTurf, that made it into the form, including the closer looks, Ed, right?
Absolutely. That was instead of putting the past performances, we'd take the and put the past performances into a couple sentences, and run them below the horse's name, and that eventually did become the closer looks in the daily racing form.
And that became a competition as to, you know, who could write those with the most, you know, clever ways. I think Bobby Smith was a master of words on those. Some of those.
Yeah, some of his I wouldn't even repeat on the air.
Well, and I was working in Manhattan. I was working at 500 Fifth Avenue. And what I loved about MetroTurf was, rather than buying a whole form, it was just a quick, like a quick overview. And it was like the last, was it, I want to say the last three performances, three most recent performances, there was like a, you know, a very abbreviated, I'm going to pull them from downstairs. I put up some Figs form stuff on Twitter, but it was just something to go to the OTB with and bet the double. And that's what I would buy MetroTurf. But boy, I remember, you know, latching on to Litvin, and that was my first introduction to him and his opinion and yours as well. And, you know, then everybody, you know, went on to the next level. But MetroTurf to me was a great, handy, quick way to go have some fun and make a couple of bets.
It was a lot of fun working on it. I do remember one of the great Bobby Smith ones was, he was talking about a horse, and he goes, has about as much chance as Mr. Magoo negotiating an S-curve on a winding highway.
or after a Christmas party or something like that. It was.
And then there was the Mr. Frisky episode, which is probably maybe the high point of our entire time at MetroTurf.
Absolutely, Ed. I'll let you tell that story.
Yes. We were we had just pretty much started MetroTurf early in January
of
90, right?
Yeah.
And this shaggy haired bearded guy comes walking in from the library where he was pretty much ensconced behind locked doors in the library. And he comes walking in with this past performances of a horse named Mr. Frisky from Puerto Rico, who was undefeated down there. And the guy's name was Steve Haskin, I think. And and he goes, look at this horse. This horse is being sent from Puerto Rico to Las Barreras. And he goes, it looks like Bold Forbes. And so, you know, wow, can we get a bet down on him in the future book? And so Steve Feldman had a connection to one of the books in Las Vegas, and he called the guy up and he goes, "Can we get a bet down on this horse, Mr. Frisky?" And the guy goes, "Who's Mr. Frisky?" And he goes, "I'll give you 100-1." So everybody in the on MetroTurf put in $10, $20 bucks, and I think we had maybe up to $100 at 100-1 odds. And then he won the probably the San Clemente and then the San Felipe and then he romped in the Santa Anita Derby and went out to Churchill Downs as the favorite in the Kentucky Derby, and we all had him at 100-1.
Yeah, he was 9-5 in the Derby.
Yeah, it was a very exciting week. And then of course apparently he'd come down sick before the race, and nobody knew it, and he just, you know, kind of wandered around the track, finished ninth or tenth, I forget what it was. It was a very, disappointing Kentucky Derby, let's put it that way.
But we had a great run at 100-1. We squeezed every ounce of fun yes, we could out of having that ticket at 100-1.
Yeah, it was certainly worth the 10-20 bucks we all put in, that's for sure.
To follow him, and I've sat in at a dinner somewhere with Ed and Steve, and when Mr. Frisky comes up, Ed, how long did MetroTurf last, and what? Why did they basically reabsorb it back into the form?
MetroTurf lasted almost exactly a year, and it hadn't been selling well, I guess. And then right when the racing time started up is when they folded MetroTurf, and we all went over to the form at that point.
Yeah, I think they were trying to beef up the form a little bit, and also they were starting its transition into desktop publishing, and we all had the experience of doing that.
That's
right.
We've
been doing that at Fixed Form. We'd all, you know, we'd work with Macintoshes and knew how to cut and copy and paste, so we were light years ahead of the guys on the copy desk at the time.
And also, you know, the racing times had taken some people away from the forum, so there were a couple positions that needed to be filled. So so they brought us over. Worked out well.
Well, and that window, I mean, you talk about what was going on at Racing Times, and we'll get Steve Crist and maybe Irwin Cohen, but Jay Pribman, Brad Free, Jay Hovde, Dan Liebman, Karen Johnson, Ray Pollock, T.D. Thornton, Chuck Streva, Jeff Lewis, Jackie Duke, Lynn Schneerson. That's my Racing Times list.
Yeah, I think you're missing a few. It was a real powerhouse. It was an all-star cast. They spared no expense. And if Robert Maxwell hadn't fallen off the back of the boat or whatever, they might still be going.
It's funny. I said Murdoch, but it was Robert Maxwell.
Robert Maxwell.
Robert Maxwell was a big rival of Murdoch's in England. And when Murdoch bought the Racing Form, Maxwell wanted to compete with him, so that's why Maxwell started the Racing Times. And actually, Maxwell had invested. I think the story was he invested $1 million in Fixed Form, and the collateral was the database and the computer equipment. And when the $1 million ran out, Robertson went back to the Maxwell organization and said, well, we ran through your $1 million. We need more. And Maxwell said, well, I'm not giving you any more. And by the way, I own your database and I own your computers. And that's when Fixed Form was shut down.
Mm-hmm.
And that database and those computers were eventually used to restart Racing Times.
Yeah, and Racing Times was also using Equibase, which was just starting. We just started publishing in 1990.
Huh. Amazing. And at that point, Evan, you went, Ed. The two of you at that point are now with the form.
Yes.
Correct.
1991, essentially.
Yes. And Dan Liebman, who had taken over from Leon Rasmussen writing the Bloodlines column, Dan Liebman moved over to the Racing Times, and so there was no Bloodlines columnist. And who was the editor of the forum then? Fred
George Burnett.
Fred Grossman. Fred Grossman calls me in and said, you're the new Bloodlines editor. Of course, I was delighted. And one of the first columns I wrote was about how Strike the Gold, although he was a very fine racehorse, did not have the dosage numbers to win the Kentucky Derby.
which endeared yourself to a certain trainer for a lifetime.
Yeah, I got a call the next day from Nick Zito, who I really didn't, you know, who I met years ago, but really didn't know at all. And he's, Eddie, how could you write something? You seem like you talked to me the other day. You seem like such a nice guy. And then you write something. My owners are calling me up saying the horse can't win the Kentucky Derby. What are you doing to me? So he cut the column out. I think the headline was the best part. No Roses on Gold Horizon was the headline.
Yeah.
And he cut that column out, and he pasted it pinned it on the stall next to Strike the Gold at Churchill Downs, and it followed him all the way through the Triple Crown. And I remember going to see Nick before the Belmont and reintroducing myself, and he goes, "Hey, man, I want to show you something." He brings me over to the stall, and there's the tap. By now it's tattered and, you know, wince, you know, sun-drenched and rain splattered, but it's still hanging up by the horse's stall. And we became pretty good friends after that.
Yeah, that was the ultimate bulletin board copy.
Anyway, I remember this is my first Bloodlines column, you know, writing my Kentucky Derby analysis, and I remember watching the Kentucky Derby that year, and watching Strike the Gold circle the field on the far turn, and begin to draw off, and Steve Haskins will always remember this. My words were, "Oh no, not Zito."
A fun, but you know, how much fun was it? Was Nick made great copy? I mean, you would think that that's a terrific winner. How much fun?
Yeah. Well, today's Blood Horse Daily is a remembrance of his bluegrass. So the story is still fresh. Story is still good.
Strike the Gold's bluegrass.
The one thing Haskett and I regret over all the years is that we didn't write down every quote from Nick. We could have put a book out.
Absolutely.
Ed, you know, I've got a. I know you don't have a Twitter, right?
No. Strictly, I'm not doing any of that social media stuff. No Twitter, no Facebook, nothing. I'm a what's the word for somebody who's anti-technology?
A hermit.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Well, I got to tell you, because you know, all of us locked up in our houses, and yesterday I'm going through some old files, and I clip and save everything. And I find that New York Post piece that I sent you, How to Spot Bad Chalk. And I put it up, and people went nuts. They loved it. And they, you know, they love seeing your name and thinking about it's funny. They all talked about the New York Post and the rivalries with Newsday and with the Daily News and you know, Russ Harris and you and, you know,
Ray Harrison.
Ray Carrison, absolutely, uh-huh. Absolutely. Preachy at Newsday and Paul Moran, of course, as well. But you know what I did with that piece? At the end, you talk about this scoring system, and I looked up that day, and you said if horses had 17 to 20 points, they were reliable favorites. Sure enough, there were two of those. They went 2 for 2. Then the ones that were, you know, sort of middle type, you know, you could bet against them, but you know, they could be all right. And the ones that were lower points in that system, the other seven races went 2 for 7, and that How to Spot Bad Chalk was all right.
That whole thing of coming up with the point systems was from my time at American Turf Monthly, because every, you know, American Turf Monthly was basically different systems to follow.
Right.
And so you always had, every month you had to come up with some new system. So you'd redboard. Yeah, you'd redboard the horses, and you'd come up with systems based on what had already happened, not on what was going to happen. Sometimes every system works for a little while until it doesn't anymore.
Exactly, yeah. Right? Like dosage.
Yes.
And Figs for me had the right field corner method. So you looked at the figo graph, which was like this big stock market type thing, and you would go to you would look for the horse with the highest number in the far right side of it, and that was the right field corner method. Is it right, Ed?
Yep, that worked too.
they all worked for. It depends on the race. It depends on the day.
Depends on the bankroll. They were very good numbers, actually, and to this day, people talk about them.
Well,
yeah, they were good numbers.
The graphing method, Jerry Brown co-opted the graphing concept for Thoroughgraph.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in many ways, Bob Sinn was way ahead of his time. He was just a terrible businessman.
Yeah, I think if he had just, as I said earlier, if he had just kept to his numbers and put out a little, two or four page sheet with just the numbers on them, he would have been doing just fine.
Yeah, he got over ambitious and hired me.
and then you hired me. So there was a lot of overhead. the computer systems alone, again, at the time, I'd never seen anything like that. I don't think many had. So I mean, I don't know what that had to have cost a fortune.
Yeah, they had somebody from CNN or MSNBC, or I don't know if MSNBC was around, but I think it was CNN came in and actually did a story on us.
Wow. Well, Ed, expand a little too. At from this point now, both of you end up really in a conventional, from that point forward, turf riding careers. And Evan, yours continues to this day, obviously, with Blood Horse. And Ed, personally for me, it's one of the great thrills as I was kind of getting started that you and Steve Askin allowed me to trail around with you guys. And those derbies, those times in Louisville for me were really formative, and just listening to the stories and learning the approaches meant a lot to me, and helped form my approach.
Well, they were very formative for Steve and I, because we got to follow Joe Hirsch around for several years.
Exactly.
And Joe was the mentor for pretty much everybody. But we actually got to have dinner with him every night and got to hear his stories. And so we got to soak up a lot of Mr. Hirsch for several years. And that was, that's something you would have paid for, and we were getting paid to do it. So that was wonderful.
Yeah, and even later, when I was at Blood Horse here in Kentucky, it was always the highlight of Derby Week when Ed would show up on the backstretch, like on Wednesday. It was always okay, now we can get started. Ed's here.
Steve and I used to when we used to do the Dawn Patrol,
yes.
which is the forerunner basically for what Mike Walsh does now for the forum.
Yep.
That was Greg Yallo's idea, actually, to send a couple guys out and analyze the workouts. And so Steve and I used to do that, and we'd usually go out to the Breeders' Cup or the Derby maybe 2 weeks in advance or close to it. And so by the time everybody else showed up, on Monday, Tuesday of Derby week, we'd already been there a week, and we felt like going home.
It's funny because I continue to spend 2 weeks in Louisville, and for me it started because we were setting up the barbecue, but then subsequently with the radio show, being there the 2 weeks has always been invaluable, and Marty McGee and myself and Mike Welsh on hand as well. But the same kind of thing, Ed, where by the time everybody else starts to maraud, you've had so much fun already, and you kind of treasure that quiet first week, when it's just more intimate, and you feel like you're kind of alone with the trainers, even though some horsemen came in, would start coming in late, Tuesday, and they would arrive a little later. Certainly Barkley Tagg, created that approach, coming in on top of the race.
One thing I do recall very fondly from the Kentucky Derby, in fact, all the Triple Crown races and the Breeders' Cup, which I have the feeling, from what I've been told, really doesn't exist anymore, was the camaraderie between all the turf riders from across the country.
Yeah.
It was like a convention. You'd see guys you hadn't seen all winter, and a lot of us were very good friends, and we'd go to dinner together, we'd go out drinking together, hang out together in the mornings, and you developed a lot of really strong friendships over all those years, and from what I've heard, that really doesn't exist as much anymore.
Yeah, there's just not the numbers there anymore. All the guys from the quote-unquote daily newspapers, they don't have people running racing anymore.
That's true. That is true. There just isn't the same quantity. Well, there's certain traditions, Ed, and I haven't used it yet, but there's a name. I've got a list of horses of names that I maintain from when we acquired in our little stable. And you coined, I don't think you coined it, but you perpetuated it, and I promise to keep it alive with a filly that will be perfect, Derby Wife. Which is the greatest thing I'd ever heard. And when you talked about, I think we were at Proof, and you talked about a Derby Wife, and I was like, "What's a Derby Wife?"
I think the late great Cliff Gilliams might have come up with that term.
Is that a Cliffy?
I think that might be a Cliff call. I'm not positive, but I think it might be.
And of course, do you want to explain to everybody what a Derby Wife is?
Well, that's, no, I don't.